Good morning. 10:30 having arrived, I call this remote meeting of the House Preventing Homelessness Division to order. First order of business, excuse me, is for the CLA to take the roll. Ms. Schmidt, do you want to go ahead?
Yes. Chair Gomez.
Gomez present.
Gomez present. Vice Chair Keeler.
Keeler present.
Vice Chair Keeler present. Lead New Brindley.
Present.
Lead New Brindley present. Davids.
Davids present.
Davids present. Heinrich.
Heinrich present.
Heinrich present. Hollins. Hollins. Hornstein.
Hornstein present.
Hornstein present. Howard.
Howard present.
Howard present. Cagle.
Present.
Cagle present. Petersburg.
Petersburg present.
Petersburg present. Ryer.
Ryer present.
Ryer present. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. Next up is approval of the minutes for March 9th, 2022. Rep. Keeler, did you have a moment to approve the minutes?
I did, Madam Chair. I moved to approve the minutes.
Perfect. Representative Keeler moves to approve the minutes for March 9th, 2022. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, if we could unmute for a moment, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 9th, 2022 are approved. So we are hearing three bills today. First up, Representative Olson has joined us. And so we have House File 3613. This bill was referred to this division from the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. We have 30 minutes scheduled for the bill and we're gonna try to wrap up by about 11 to vote. I will move that House File 3613 be re-referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. So your bill is before us. Rep. Olson, will you tell us about your bill?
Yeah, good morning, everybody. Good morning, Chair Gomez, Vice Chair Keeler, and the committee. As I said before, I'm really glad to be here. I don't think I've had a bill up before, so it's a pleasure to be stopping through. So House File 3613 is the Shelter-Linked Mental Health Grant Program funding, and this was the mental health grant program was established by the legislature in 2019 in response to the incredible need we were hearing from services supporting youth experiencing homelessness and youth in safe harbor settings who had experienced sexual exploitation. It was designed based on the success of our school-linked mental health grants over the past decade of experience in Minnesota. And similar to school-linked, the shelter-linked grant integrates community-based mental health staff into shelter sites to build rapport, deliver group and individual mental health supports, and to equip staff to better meet the mental health needs. And through the pandemic, we know that there has been a substantially increased mental health need. And what we have seen is tremendously positive impact of integrating mental health supports in how we care for youth through the shelter-linked mental health grant program. You will hear about the specifics of this grant today from the testifiers. Unfortunately, at this time, we're also seeing our homeless youth system increasingly being relied upon as the final safety net for youth with mental illness. Due to these concerning observations, DHS convened a stakeholder discussion to better understand this crisis in both our mental health and homeless youth service systems. Though the challenges are incredibly complex, one clear refrain from the conversations was the observation that the shelter-linked mental health grant program is delivering clear benefits for youth and services they rely on. So House File 3613 proposes to build on what is working and proposes to expand the grant to include more homeless youth in safe harbor sites by investing $1.65 million from the general fund into these critical services. With five of the 55 eligible service sites implementing shelter-linked mental health from the $500,000 in the initial funding, we believe this additional investment can substantially increase access to this critical service. So with that, Madam Chair, I have several testifiers, and first is the Executive Director of Face to Face.
Thank you so much, Representative Olson. Welcome to the committee. Hannah Getachew Krisur. I would love it if you would correct my pronunciation of your name, introduce yourself to the committee, and go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Representative Gomez and Representative Olson. My name is Hannah Getachew Krisur. And I'm the executive director of Face-to-Face Health and Counseling in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm also trained as a mental health therapist. Thank you for this opportunity. Face-to-Face provides comprehensive services for marginalized youth and those who have experienced complex trauma, including homelessness. We provide medical, mental health care, housing and support services, and justice system divergent support for youth. Face-to-Face received the Shelter Link Mental Health funding to provide services at three youth-serving organizations, including Face-to-Face, Anda Young, and Avenues for Youth. We also provide mental health care, case consultation, and training for staff across organizations. I'm deeply grateful for the state of Minnesota for recognizing the seriousness of mental health issues among youth experiencing homelessness and sexual exploitation and making such funding available. I started working in the shelter system with youth experiencing homelessness before such funding was available. We struggled to appropriately connect young people to resources coming from the streets with untreated mental illness, tremendous amount of pain and trauma with no access to services. Undiagnosed, untreated mental illness was clearly linked to the factors contributing to the instability in the lives of our youth. As we all know, our communities have seen tremendous spike in mental health issues in the past few years and months. We have been seeing an increase of symptoms, needs, and struggling with coping for our youth. Huge increase in hopelessness for the future. Through the Shelter Linked Mental Health funding, we've been able to meet people where they're at, being responsive to their needs individually as a collective and culturally as it relates to their care. We, for example, we have supported one youth go back to family, find family, work on connecting back to family and having family meetings to support that. We've had at least one person who was able to move out of the shelter into another state for college. The homeless youth system has seen an increase in youth needing intensive support with mental health. Our youth come to us with complex trauma history on top of experiencing homelessness, which studies confirm is a source of trauma by itself. The recent layers of global stressors have exacerbated the issues our youth are facing. All of us struggled during the pandemic. Our young, vulnerable, and marginalized are suffering even more. Depression, anxiety, and suicidality have been increasing at alarming rates. The homeless youth programs and systems have been a safety net for these youth. A young person said to me once, "I may find a job or find housing, but how am I going to keep it when I cannot manage what's happening in my head?" As we see growing crisis, it is critical that we build up on what works. We are truly inspired by what we have experienced to date with the ShelterLink grant. The current funding level is a tiny drop in the bucket compared to the extensive needs in our community and state. I ask for your support to expand this grant to give more youth access to this critical intervention service to support them as they transition from surviving to thriving in their lives. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Getachew Krisur. Next, we have Karen Yard. Ms. Yard, if you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony. Let's see. I'm trying to see if Ms. Yard is. Oh, okay. Great. Hi, welcome.
Hey, welcome and thank you for this opportunity to share my story and the Hope Street Shelter story. My name is Karen Yardi, and I have been at Hope Street Shelter for almost 2 years now. My role as a shelter-based headway emotional health therapist is to provide therapy services, individual therapy services, and also to be a voice for many of the youth who don't always have those services. Headway Emotional Health is a community mental health agency which has been serving the Twin Cities area since 1970 with the guiding principle of trauma-informed care. And this means the basis of my work as a mental health therapist is to provide that service as well with the Hope Street youth. A large part of my work with the homeless youth at Hope Street is engagement and building rapport, as there's a major lack of trust in organized systems and authority figures among the youth that we see. COVID-19 has not helped the situation for many of our youth, because we've seen an increase in the last year or so in the number of people who are coming through the doors of Hope Street. I spend most of my time building relationships, and I feel honored when I'm let in by many of the youth that we serve. As a mental health provider, it's important for me to build these relationships by listening, valuing, and accepting these clients as worthwhile individuals, because this affords me the opportunity to provide services that most will not necessarily have in the wider community. Additionally, I work to normalize and validate most of their current symptoms and problems through psychoeducation and providing specific coping skills for many of them to normalize the traumatization, because homelessness in itself is also traumatizing. I would just like to share one of the incredible stories of one of the youth who have come through the doors of Hope Street Shelter. And her name is Brandy. She's a 20-year-old African-American female who presented to Hope Street after spending most of her early adulthood and most of her childhood moving around from family members from state to state. She came to Minnesota from Indiana about 2 years ago to live with an aunt, but that relationship quickly deteriorated and she found herself homeless until a friend told her about Hope Street. Initially, Brandy was skeptical because she could not trust others and she could not find safe and secure housing, and she felt nobody was going to help her with quote unquote her issues. Brandy's first few days at the shelter were drama filled and hard, because according to her, everything set me off. She had a difficult time adjusting to rules and structure. And as she said, I didn't want people telling me what to do or getting into my business. I met Brandy for about a month for a few minutes at a time with a meet and greet, just getting to know her, just getting to share about our services and just letting her know that I am available. I am there. She needs someone to talk to. I'm a great listener. And eventually, about a month after Brandy moved into the shelter, she did share her story. And it was a story with lots of hurt, lots of trauma, lots of rage, lots of anger, and sarcasm. But beneath that exterior, there was also a person who was also incredibly resourceful, resilient, and above all, helpful. She was really endearing to many of the other residents who found her voice to be endearing. And after a month or living at the shelter, she did proceed to fill out some applications for housing. She sent to me December 1st, she sent me this message. Thank you, Miss Karen, for help, for taking the time out to talk and listen to me. I really needed that, and I was on the verge of doing something really stupid. I really appreciate you and all your help. I got accepted from my apartment and I moved out on January 1st. This is one of the examples of how mental health and the sort of resources for the bill can actually make a difference in the lives of many of the youth that we see. Many who will never accept the services, or many who will never be able to go into the other sources of treatment. And this is the transformative power of providing the mental health services in the shelter setting. Thank you so much for supporting and expanding the grant to transform mental health and to provide services for our youth. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Yardy, and thank you for sharing the story of the young person that you worked with. We really appreciate hearing that. Next, we have Colleen Davern joining us as a testifier. If you could introduce yourself to the committee for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
Good morning, Chair and members of the community. My name is Colleen Davern. I am a co-occurring therapist in both mental health and addiction, and I work with youth in shelters through Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota in Duluth. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to share about this program and the profoundly positive impact that it has had on the youth that we serve. One of the most impactful aspects of shelter-linked mental health is it removes most, if not all, external barriers to services. Through this grant, shelters provide rapid, if not immediate, mental health services to youth that would not have access to it without this grant. In addition to removing the external barriers, this grant uniquely allows for addressing internal barriers to achieving mental wellness. Through embedding mental health into the shelters, the culture of the shelter itself shifts from a safe place to sleep into being a place of learning, exploring, and growth. Through specialized training with staff on positive reinforcement, motivational interviewing, and engagement strategies, mental wellness can now be seen as an integral part of being human. The stigma of being broken, bad, or flawed is removed, and it's replaced with a culture of empathy and connection, because we all struggle some days, and we need to normalize this. Often youth in the shelters have been sent to therapy as a punishment by schools, caregivers, or other authorities, and it creates a fear of therapy. This grant allows therapists like myself to be proactive with the youth and provide therapeutic services in a very organic and authentic way that resonates with them. This allows the youth to overcome their own internal fears and hesitation in addressing mental health and wellness. The grant provides amazing opportunities to be proactive with high-risk youth in addressing and preventing substance abuse. The youth are able to learn coping skills and build connections with others to increase overall well-being, and it decreases that need or desire to engage in escape through substances in ways that other programs cannot. Staff at our location are continuing to learn how to engage youth to discuss goals, barriers, and strengths. They help the youth gain self-esteem and learn how to use their strengths to achieve their goals. Many youth have been able to set goals they would not have thought possible prior to entering an environment of positive reinforcement and support. Some of these can be as simple as completing high school that they never thought they would be able to do, or holding down a job. Some of them have goals of even reconnecting with family that they never thought was possible. The staff work with them to empower them to talk about their responses to things without judgment, and helps them choose healthier behaviors. This leads to better relationships and more positive outcomes. With the help of this grant, the youth can learn that mental wellness is a lifelong journey and that they have a support system to aid them through it. I want to thank Representative Olson for your leadership, and thank you, Chair and members, for your support of ShelterLink Mental Health. As a team, we can continue to work to build resiliency and hope within the youth that we serve in these shelters.
Thank you so much, Ms. Davern, for sharing your testimony with us. I will just note that we also have Kirsten Anderson of Aspire Minnesota on hand to help answer any questions. Are there any member questions? I'm not seeing any so far, but we'll give a moment. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question as much as a comment. First of all, to thank Representative Olson for this excellent bill. And I was really struck by Ms. Davern's testimony, particularly, I wrote this down, that you know, these services are an integral part of being human. And I really thought that was just well put. And I just wanted to share, Madam Chair, with the committee, just in the last couple of weeks, you know, I had a group of pediatricians, came for, Pediatric Day on the Hill. The number one thing they talked about was mental health and just the dire need of youth mental health services. You know, I've been walking the line with the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. You know, my daughter is a teacher. And, you know, one of their key demands is mental health services in the school. And then I met with the Bridge for Youth, which provides these services in the district I represent, and this came up again. So just and just seems like everyone I'm talking to, everywhere I'm going these days, youth mental health services is number one on the agenda. And so in this context, it's so critically important, Representative Olson. And so I'm really appreciate you bringing this bill, and I strongly support it. And I think, you know, we have to really look at this as in terms of just a much broader crisis that needs to be addressed. So thank you to the testifiers, and thank you, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize, my internet is a little unstable this morning, so I'm gonna keep my camera off in hopes that you can at least hear me okay. But my question is, there was $250,000 appropriated in 2020 and 2021. I'm wondering if we know how those grants were distributed, and certainly we have already heard from testifiers on the impact of those grants. So I'm just wondering if we know how that initial investment was distributed.
Thank you, Rep. New Brindley. Representative Olson, I did see that Ms. Anderson turned on her camera, but if you want to field it or pass it to her, that's up to you.
I'll pass it to her, but I know the DHS did a really great report I would direct members to as well on these grant reports that shows, to Representative New Brindley, if she wants more detail, it's an excellent report to show where it went, how it was. It's a really incredible numbers, but I think Ms. Anderson can give you that detail right now.
Great. Thanks, Rep. Olson. Ms. Anderson, welcome to the committee. Please just say your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kirsten Anderson. I'm with Aspire, Minnesota. Thank you for the question, Representative New Brindley. I would say that the Department of Human Services did a very thorough job in developing our RFP. And as you can see in their report, as Representative Olson referenced, there are five grantees in this first round that were evaluated based on the partnership demonstrated between the community-based provider with the expertise in mental health and the plan established between that organization and the homeless youth or safe harbor organization for how it was that they were going to truly integrate that mental health service delivery model into their services. And I'll just say that, you know, Aspire Minnesota is an association of children's service providers across the state, and we talk endlessly about children's mental health. Representative Hornstein's comment, this is really an unprecedented crisis. And I will say about this grant program in particular, it is one where we really see all of our colleagues just light up with the joy of seeing that this is really making such a meaningful impacts on young people and on service delivery. And so that's not measurable, but it is really significant, I think, that we have found something that's really working in an environment where there is a lot of challenge.
Thank you very much, Ms. Anderson. Also, just so that members know, the report that Representative Olson references is in our packet that was distributed, and it's available on the committee website also. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I did look at that. It's excellent. My question then would be, with adding these additional funds, do we anticipate adding additional grantees, or are we anticipating sort of amplifying those who have received the funds already? I mean, clearly, while certainly good work has been done with this, these awards are not huge, right? I mean, $30,000 for the biennium to one of the groups. So I'm just wondering if we anticipate being able to just amplify that, or if we anticipate adding additional grantees or both.
Representative Olson, I saw that Ms. Anderson took herself off mute, so maybe we'll go to her if that's okay with you. Great. Ms. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Brindley, you know, I think that there has been really generative conversation in this topic area, acknowledging to your observation that $30,000 is substantive, but doesn't take us to a complete solution. So I think that it's a both and. We have 55 sites across the state that could truly benefit substantially from adding this component to their service delivery model to serve young people. And so I think that definitely the goal would be to expand the benefit to additional jurisdictions, organizations, you know, geographies, but also to think about how it is that we make sure that those grants are making a meaningful impact wherever they're planted.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Representative New Brindley.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Anderson, and thank you, Representative Olson, for bringing the bill.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My thanks to Representative Olson for this legislation. I'm really happy to see it. I just wanted to make the observation that last month I hosted a legislative listening session for Dakota County and included stakeholders from across the county, from government units to service providers to people who are experiencing homelessness. And the same thing, same theme of youth homelessness, the same theme of meeting them where they are, of investing in mental health and having the patience that I heard Ms. Yardy describe in terms of building relationship and communication. A shout out and my appreciation for this legislation.
Thank you so much, Representative Ryer. I'm not seeing any other member questions or comments. Just before we go to Rep. Olson for a couple of closing remarks, I think that efforts like this really reflect a response to the issues that we hear about all the time in this committee, which are that, you know, a lot of folks who are seeking help with shelter and with housing are experiencing mental health issues and substance use disorder issues. And those are areas that we have just profoundly underfunded for decades. And we're seeing the impacts of that disinvestment and underfunding in other parts of our social safety net. And so this is just a really important effort to meet people where they physically are and provide those services so that they can find the stability that they need in their lives. So thank you so much, Rep. Olson, and I'll go to you for any closing comments.
Thank you, and thank you to the testifiers for being here and, more importantly, for the work you do to implement these programs. I'll just say that as the bill author, what I really appreciate about this is the dauntingness of like mental health and issues around homelessness, but then to have something that is this hopeful. Like when I personally read through that DHS report, I was really moved by the opportunity that like we have a solution and we know what to do. And so bringing this bill forward and that your willingness to hear it, Chair Gomez, and to have this conversation is incredibly hopeful in the face of some really daunting challenges. And just want to say thank you for your support of House File 3613.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Representative Olson. Hearing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3613 be re-referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. And the clerk will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Chair Gomez, aye. Vice Chair Keeler.
Keeler, aye.
Vice Chair Keeler, aye. Lead New Brindley.
Aye.
Lead New Brindley, aye. Davids.
Davids, aye.
Davids, aye. Heinrich.
Heinrich, aye.
Heinrich, aye. Hollins.
Hollins, aye.
Hollins, aye. Hornstein.
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Howard.
Howard, aye.
Howard, aye. Cagle.
Cagle, aye.
Cagle, aye. Petersburg.
Petersburg, aye.
Petersburg, aye. Breyer.
Breyer, aye.
Breyer, aye. We have 11 ayes.
There being 11 ayes and 0 nays, the motion passes. And Representative Olson, House File 3613 is on its way back to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. Thank you so much. All right, next on the agenda, we have House File 4192 from Vice Chair Keeler. This bill was referred to the division from the Human Services Committee. We have about 15 minutes scheduled for this bill, and we'll plan to wrap up and vote at about 11:15. I'd like to move that House File 4192 be re-referred to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. So House File 4192 is before us. Vice Chair Keeler, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As we all remember last year, we actually passed into law the Shelter Task Force. This group is up and running and doing some amazing things. We have a preliminary report. One of the things they realized is they just need a little bit more time because this is a really complex conversation and a complex issue. And so In the original task force language, it said that the final report was going to be submitted on August 31st of 2022. Because that was passed into session law, now we have a new bill to make an adjustment. The only adjustment is that they're asking for an extension of that final report to be December 15th, 2022. As the author who worked on the first bill, the intention that we had had originally was that we wanted to see this report in plenty of time to be able to look to see if there was any legislation we needed to move, but we feel having a report done by December 15th both allows them the adequate time that they need and us as well to have enough time to review it to see if movement needs to be made in the session. That is my bill, Madam Chair. I don't have any testifiers, but open for any questions.
Excellent. Thank you, Representative Keeler. Are there any questions from members about this extension of the Shelter Task Force timeline? Okay, just give another second, but I'm not seeing any right off the bat. All right, Vice Chair Keeler, any closing comments?
That'd be it. When our task force asks for more time, I think it means they're doing diligent work and we should give them that. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler. Hearing no further discussion, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 4192 be re-referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. And the clerk will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Chair Gomez, aye. Vice Chair Keeler.
Keeler, aye.
Vice Chair Keeler, aye. Lead New Brindley.
Aye.
Lead New Brindley, aye. Davids.
Davids, aye.
Davids, aye. Heinrich.
Heinrich, aye.
Heinrich, aye. Hollins.
Hollins, aye.
Hollins, aye. Hornstein.
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Howard.
Howard, aye.
Howard, aye. Cagle.
Cagle, aye.
Cagle, aye. Petersburg.
Petersburg, aye.
Petersburg, aye. Breyer.
Breyer, aye.
Breyer, aye. We have 11 ayes.
There being 11 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 4225, I believe. Let me see. Hold on. Sorry. No, that's my bill. Okay. 4192. Sorry. 4192 is on its way back to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. I'm sorry. I didn't note that Representative Hollins had joined us, but we've noted that for the agenda. Thanks, Rep. Hollins. And now I'm going to pass the fake gavel to Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Finally on the agenda, we have House File 4225 from Chair Gomez. This bill was referred to this division from Human Services Committee. I will move that House File 2425 be re-referred to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. We have before us House File 4225. Chair Gomez, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Excuse me. House File 4225 requires cities to develop policies to deal with encampments. You'll hear in a little bit from our research partners at the Wilder Foundation, but after seeing a drop off overall in the rate of homelessness, kind of in the last decade or so, it's on the way back up, just the overall numbers, the rate, and increasingly, people are staying outside of our shelter system in places that are not suitable for human habitation. Here at the Capitol, we can see this, I'm sure, as all of us drive in and out of our workplace. We see that people, even in the winter, even in Minnesota, are sleeping in tents on a lot of times on public land, sometimes on private land. So the reason that I just want to tell, I've talked about this a bit, but like the origin story of this committee and my place in this work has to do with encampments and a particular encampment. After George Floyd was killed in my district, there was an encampment behind Target on Lake Street. If you guys know where that is, it's like near the Third Precinct, which burned down, and the Target caught on fire at some point during those days. And it's kind of connected to Target's connected to the rest of the city by the Midtown Greenway, which is a former rail corridor, or maybe it's still a rail corridor, but it's now, but it now has a bike path. But it has also been a place where people have stayed outside. So when this fire happened, there was, you know, talking to folks about who were there. I wasn't there myself, but it was terrifying. It was a real safety issue, kind of like people had to be moved very quickly. Some people moved onto the Greenway. A lot of folks, this was, of course, during COVID. There was guidance issued by the Centers for Disease Control during COVID that local municipalities were not to displace encampments of homeless people during the COVID crisis, because, you know, it was just considered too dangerous to kind of like disperse people into community with nowhere to go. You know, a series of events happened. Some people moved into a hotel that was close by the area of Lake in Chicago, a lot of which burned down. A lot of the buildings there no longer are there. But eventually, you know, hundreds of people ended up staying in a park that was close to my house called Powderhorn Park. It's a big park, middle of the south side of Minneapolis. And it happened to coincide with, I remember that we were in special session doing our work on public safety that during that time, and special session ended. And, you know, I was going through the experience of George Floyd's killing in my district and the area burning down. I sent my family away because I felt like at a certain point I couldn't provide for their safety and do my job. So I kind of found myself after special session with time on my hands and a great need in the middle of my community in the form of this encampment. And so I spent a lot of time there. I'm like a night owl, so I would do night shifts, working security. I met a lot of the people who, you know, who took up residence there. I hadn't had that experience before of, you know, people I know have experienced homelessness, certainly. I have loved ones who suffer with major mental health issues, with major substance use disorder issues. I've lost a lot of friends, you know, to heroin overdoses in particular. I was like a punk rocker in the 2000s, so it was before the before the opioid crisis hit a lot of communities. I definitely had experience with that. But I guess, you know, I'm sharing the story because some of the things that I learned just talking to folks who lived there were just really shaped the way that I relate to this work and changed my understanding of this issue, of the issue of homelessness, and especially the issue of unsheltered homelessness. You know, I think we've talked quite a bit in this committee about some of the challenges that people face in accessing shelter. And that's why, you know, I'm thankful that we just passed the extension of the shelter task force, because that was like the challenge that brought that group together. Because we know that sort of this, some of our traditional big congregate shelters are not meeting the needs of people who are facing homelessness. You know, those challenges include just like conditions in the shelter. People experience incidents of violence, of theft of their belongings, feeling unsafe in that space. You know, I spent a lot of time in the Powderhorn encampment with former Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board Commissioner Londell French. And his professional background is as an ESP, an education support professional in our public schools. And also he worked as a bouncer in a club in like the 2000s. And so it was just interesting because he was like, he talked about the way that those two experiences were so, you know, he worked with special ed kids. And he said that he's like, a lot of the people staying here are vulnerable adults. And that is like this way that, you know, and so they're subject to predatory practices in a lot of different ways. And so that was something that stuck with me as I would hear people talk about their bad experiences in shelter and how people would prefer to sleep in a tent in a park than to sleep in shelter. And that kind of blew my mind at first. You know, we talked about the sort of challenges of the congregate setting. A lot of people, you have to be sober at the moment that you enter the facility, which is very difficult for a lot of people. You know, a lot of people use substances to deal with the trauma of their lives, with the trauma of being on the street, with the cold, with the elements. You see people using alcohol or other like kind of central nervous system numbing agents just to deal with the physical realities of living on the streets. And, you know, also something that really has stuck with me is the fact that so many people who are experiencing unsheltered homelessness have had systems, have had a lot of interactions with systems, whether that is incarceration or foster care, as we've heard with our young people. And I heard people say, you know, I just need to like be somewhere where people aren't telling me what to do. And I have a space that's mine and I have some control over something in my life. And so that was like the way that something that looks to maybe look to me at first, like, God, a tent in a park, like that's just a hard way to live. Like, you know, and not understanding why somebody would choose that. I really developed more of an understanding of what it feels like as a person, right, to always be hemmed in, to always be, to always have somebody telling you what to do, to always be under kind of strict regulations. And like, I get to do whatever I want in my house, you know, and people want to be able to do what they want in their houses. And so sometimes we have people, you know, choosing to live outdoors instead of choosing these sort of more institutionalized settings. You know, of course, also big congregate settings, you often have to leave from 6 or 7 a.m. until the evening time. There's the challenge of what to do with your belongings during that time. What do you do with yourself? Where do you go? And so, you know, I think that since we have seen an increase in people staying in encampments, people staying outdoors, people staying in areas not fit for human habitation, we have made progress, but we haven't made enough progress. I think that there are still our response to unsheltered homelessness broadly as a kind of government apparatus has been to displace them continuously. Often when you displace somebody who is in unsheltered homelessness, who's living in a tent, they don't like you to call them bulldozers. I guess they're bobcats, but they'll bring little machines to scoop people's stuff up and throw it away. We hear a lot of times about people losing, you know, priceless heirlooms or losing photo albums. We had a situation where a woman was scooped up in 2020 inside of a tent by a worker removing an encampment. And so all of that is to say that you know, we don't really have solid policies in place to respond to what is the emerging trend in homelessness in our communities. So this is an attempt to require cities to develop these policies, to have clear ways of notifying people who are staying outside when and how they will be removed from that area or moved along. It requires, again, posted notice of plans to remove, collaboration with social services, plans for dealing with people's personal belongings, and says basically that, you know, we have to put some thought and put some parameters in place to make decisions about how to deal with unsheltered homelessness. And really, you know, to have policies that that treat people humanely, even when they're in really difficult spots in their lives. And so that's what the that's what House File 4225 does. I have a few testifiers who have joined us. I want to note that this is, you know, I've obviously been on trying to understand this issue more completely and putting this bill out there. The bill's not perfect in its current form. There's work that needs to be done on it. Sometimes in the legislature, like, you put something out and then people are like, oh, hey, you're trying to do this thing that I'm not really crazy about, so I'm going to give you feedback on it. So I've gotten a lot of really great feedback on it, and I'm committed to coming together with cities and counties and, you know, departments, agencies at the state that have been dealing with this to develop really, you know, good framework for having, you know, humane and thoughtful policies about encampments. So thank you, Madam Chair. And I have some testifiers. We also have a video that we're going to show, I think, after our first testifier, if that's okay. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. We'll move on to testifiers. First on our list, we have Michelle Durard from Wilder Research. If you can start with introducing us with your name, title, and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. And representatives. I'm Michelle Decker-Girard. I'm a senior research manager at Wilder Research, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Homeless Study and the Reservation Homeless Study. And I'm going to share a PowerPoint this morning and walk through it. And I believe you received this in materials as well. So I believe that most of you are very familiar with our study of homelessness that we have done, but Wilder Research has coordinated and conducted a study of homelessness every 3 years since 1991. So in the 80s, when we started to see an increase in the number of homeless people on the streets, we worked with Ramsey County and then were asked to do statewide. And what we do is two components, a 45-minute interview with people experiencing homelessness, as well as a count of everybody staying in emergency shelter, domestic violence shelters, transitional housing facilities, people who are vouchered into motels, as well as people who are unsheltered, who we're talking about today. So we do a count as well as interviews with folks. So last time we did the study in 2018, we talked to about 5,000 people who were experiencing homelessness in a 24-hour period. This study uses volunteers to conduct the face-to-face interviews, and we release a bunch of information throughout the period after the study that's helpful in planning policies and program implementation across the state. So we write reports on special populations like veterans, older adults, LGBTQ, homelessness, youth homelessness, et cetera. But with today's presentation, I'm just going to give you a little bit of the characteristics of homelessness from our last study. And again, we do it every 3 years, but we missed it last year because of the pandemic. So we'll be doing it within the next year. So this data is based on our 2018 numbers. So as Chair Gomez was saying, after leveling off in the early 2000s, we saw an increase in homelessness starting around 2009. We had a big jump at the height of the recession. And then during the last time we did the study, we also saw an over 20% increase in people experiencing homelessness. And you can see by this slide, about a third of our homeless population are children with their parents. We have more children experiencing homelessness today than the whole population of homeless folks when we first started doing the study back in 1991. If we include people counted on American Indian reservations who meet the federal definition of homelessness, it's over 11,300 people who are homeless on that single night that we did the study. We use the data from our study to estimate who we missed, because homelessness is a visible issues. You can count folks and talk to folks who are staying in shelter, but there's a lot of folks that don't come into contact with the system. And so we estimate that there are 19,600 people in Minnesota who experience homelessness on any given night, and over 50,000 people in our state who experience homelessness over the course of a year. So who makes up our homeless population in Minnesota? Almost half of our homeless population are children and youth, age 24 and younger, and the rest are adults and older adults. The biggest increase in age groups that we saw during our last study in 2018 was in our older adult population, age 55 plus, where we saw a 25% increase in the number of older adults experiencing homelessness over the previous study. It's still a smaller number compared to their representation in the overall population, but still a big hike. And some of those older adults have also health concerns that are particularly an issue during a pandemic. So for instance, when the pandemic hit, we used our data to help inform the FEMA application to understand who had complex health issues that needed immediate assistance in helping them during the pandemic. So just going through a few key findings from the study. So one of the issues, of course, key finding from our study is that gap between income, what people can afford, and rent. And this has only increased since the time of this study. So the median income of our population of people experiencing homelessness in Minnesota is $550 a month. It ranges. There's quite a few people that are on zero, but you know, the average is $550. The median rent is over $900 a month for a one-bedroom apartment. So you can see that there is a big gap between what people earn and what the rents are in our state. What we find is like people really need subsidized housing to be able to afford rent. And so that's your Section 8 vouchers and other types of rental assistance so that people can have housing affordability. About half of our homeless adults that we spoke to were on a waiting list for that subsidized housing. And another 10 to 15% couldn't even get on the waiting list because it was full. And so there is a very big need for the subsidized housing vouchers and other rental assistance. And during the pandemic, a lot of that rental assistance was available, and now that's starting to, you know, end because of that a lot of that was COVID-related money. And we asked a bunch of questions about why people are homeless and what led to people's homelessness. And the number one most common answer is that there's just no housing that they can afford. So it is, you know, coming down to the affordability issue and what housing is available. So 56% of homeless adults said that there is no housing that they could afford. Second major finding of our last study was the number of folks that we counted outside of the formal shelter setting. So we saw a 62% increase in people not in shelters over the previous study. One of the questions we ask is how, you know, have you been turned away from shelter in the last 3 months due to lack of available space? And about a third of our population has been turned away in the last 3 months. So people are staying in a variety of settings. They might stay in shelter one night. They might stay on the streets or camping one night or in a car. We see this throughout our entire state. So it's not just a metro issue. You know, in greater Minnesota, it looks a little bit differently. Sometimes we know that people stay in cabins without heat or any type of electricity. They might stay in a fish house. They might stay temporarily doubled up one night on somebody's couch and then the next night camping. So there is this movement in our population experiencing homelessness. Even if on the night of the study, we talked to them in shelter, they might have stayed in the previous week outside. So that leads to a question that we ask. We ask a question about where have you stayed in the last 30 days? So even if we interviewed the folks in shelter that night, were they outside in the past month? And over a quarter of our adults and 22% of our youth had stayed more than a week outside in the past month, even if we talked to them that night in shelter. And people are also staying doubled up, particularly our youth population, as you all are aware of. There's couch hoppers bouncing from place to place, and that can lead to also a lot of instability. So 70% of our adults and 38% of our youth had stayed at least a week doubled up or couch hopping in the last month. The other thing that we just want to note is sort of the chronic health issues facing homeless folks. So we see sort of this overlapping health issues between serious mental health issues, chronic health issues, and substance abuse disorder. So 81% of our homeless population has at least one of those issues. And so it's something to take into consideration when planning programming and policies. We've seen a steady increase in those with serious mental health issues over the time of doing our study, as well as an increase in those who have chronic health conditions. And, you know, if you go into a shelter or work with people experiencing homelessness, you see more and more people with diabetes, with, you know, oxygen machines that they have to deal with, asthma, and chronic pain and other health issues. And so that is something that is particularly evident in the unsheltered population. We see higher numbers of these issues in that population. Another obstacle to getting and keeping housing is the number of women who experience domestic violence. And this was our all-time high. Over about 37% of women left their last housing because of abuse, domestic violence situations. And that trend line has increased over time since we started doing this study. One thing that we dug into in the last two studies was trauma in childhood. So we see that in our homeless population, that homelessness is often preceded by childhood trauma and abuse. So when you think about those adverse childhood experiences, they directly have had impact in the lives of our people experiencing homelessness. And one of the analysis we did was whether or not you had this experience in your childhood and what was the age of first homelessness. And as you can see by this table, if people had had a parent who served time in prison when they were a child, their average age at first homelessness was 19 versus age 30 if you did not have that experience. So there's this opportunity for intervention by helping kids and families who have these experiences early to prevent homelessness in adulthood. And then thinking about the ripple effects from discriminatory practices, generational racism, housing practices that discriminate against BIPOC communities, such as, redlining, who could get access to loans for housing, et cetera. That has had a huge impact, as you all know, on our homeless population. So in Minnesota's population, 5% of folks are Black or African American, but in our homeless population, it's 37%. And that's also true for American Indians, where 1% of our state's population is Indigenous or American Indian, but 12% of our homeless population. And these disparities vary in different sections of the state. In greater Minnesota, we have a high disparity with our American Indian or Native populations. And in the Twin Cities metro area, about half of our homeless population is Black or African American. So that just gives you a little bit of overview of some of the information that's available. We have a lot more information and can dig into any questions that people have in particular as you're moving forward with this bill. And we also have a lot of information on our website. So with that, that concludes my presentation. Thank you for having me today.
Thank you, Ms. Gerard. That was a lot of information. And I know I'll be following up with you on some questions, and I'm sure others will as well. I think you presented that in housing also, and so we're getting information out for more people that's helpful. At this point, we're going to move on. We actually have a video, so Ms. Schmidt, if you could get the video ready, we'll be hearing from somebody via video, and then the rest of the testifiers will be 2 minutes. We just wanted to have enough time to really get that presentation in.
Madam Chair?
Yep, go ahead.
Oh, just before Ms. Schmidt runs the video, I just wanted to say a couple of things about it for an intro.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks, Madam Chair. So there's an encampment in Minneapolis that was evicted this morning. So police showed up. People who were staying there, there were like 30 people staying in tents, I believe, had to leave. So we were originally having some live testimony, but this was what we could kind of put together on short notice. I want to say a couple things about the video. I think there's one swear word, just so people are aware. This video was taken shortly after a really traumatic event for this individual. And so, you know, he's emotional. And so, you know, I guess I just wanted people to know it's sensitive testimony. There is one obscenity in it, I believe. So just if anybody's watching with kids and don't want them to hear that, please plan accordingly. She asks him in the middle, kind of like, is there anything that you want state lawmakers to know? But I just wanted people to know that we did get explicit consent for him to share this. And his name is Navo. And Madam Chair, that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. We'll move on with the video.
You can tell me what you want me to point it at. Okay. We're just here where the North Loop was just evicted this morning. Do you mind sharing what happened?
Just getting woken up, telling us, you know, that we had to go. You know, without even giving us a notice or anything. Like, I go through this every day. It's hard for me.
I'm really sorry.
I lost two babies while being confident and shit. Stress is crazy.
I'm really sorry that happened. This video is going to be shown to state lawmakers. Is there anything you want them to know?
It's people's beat. It's going to do something for us. Just give us a spot where we can just go and act alone.
Would you like that spot to be indoors or outdoors?
Be outdoors, indoors, no matter. Shelter doesn't do it for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I deal with the same. I'm more free outside than I'm inside. Outside, the inside gets your shit stolen. All here, this risk, bro.
Well, thank you.
I didn't lose a lot of stuff. My team got burnt up here before due to the fact that somebody had rage against somebody, so my team got on fire. My wife ended up being suffering for it. She ended up getting a frostbite. Nobody wanted to help her. We lost baby due to the stress and the environment. Where can we run to? We can't run to nowhere else.
I'm sorry. Those stories are always so hard to hear. We're going to move on to our next testifier, Deidre Nass, if you can please, is she here? There you are. If you can let the committee know your name, and you can move on with your testimony.
Hello, my name is Deidre Nass, and my family and my five children and husband live directly across the street from an encampment located on City of Minneapolis-owned land. This encampment has been on our block for 12 weeks. My in-laws' home is right next to the encampment to the south, and they purchased this home to be a part of our community and to live across the street from their grandkids. Our street is home to a diverse group of working class people. Our block is home to many children, including kids who are neurodiverse, blind, and who have epilepsy. Our block also has a group home for vulnerable adults, numerous Habitat for Humanity homes, and many first-generation American families, including a refugee family from Somalia who shares the fence on the north side of the encampment. We love our block, and we try to take care of one another to the best of our ability, and this includes our unhoused neighbors living in the encampment. But there's only so much we can do with the resources we have. I'm thankful to you, Chair Gomez, and to you, Representative Keeler, for bringing forward HF4225 to require that local governments grapple with how their community's values can be memorialized in creating policies that address provisions for notice, the handling of personal property, severe weather plans, and health and hygiene for encampments for people experiencing homelessness. I'm hopeful that your leadership will inspire the city of Minneapolis and other cities to create clear and transparent policies about their responses to encampments. My neighbors and I have been struggling on how to be supportive to those living in the encampment while feeling, frankly, really in the dark about what the city of Minneapolis's policies and procedures are. We have come to learn that the city has not updated this policy since 1960. We have begged for clear information and partnership from the city, and we want to be constructive partners in resolving this situation positively for everyone impacted, but we feel completely bewildered. Our questions and requests to the city have been, one, what is their plan to find housing and other safe locations for those living in the encampments? We understand that several of the people at this site do have housing, and we have repeatedly asked what is being done to help them stabilize in their own homes. There are at least two people in the encampment who cannot walk without assistance, and many others who have obvious healthcare needs that are not being sufficiently met, even though the amazing nurses with healthcare for the homeless do their very best. Two, despite many of us repeatedly emailing the mayor's office and the health department, it was only at week 10 that a porta potty and a hand sanitizing station was placed at the site. For the people in the encampment, this meant being without the most basic of human hygiene needs. And for neighbors of the encampment, this meant that we frequently found human waste in our yards. Three, what is the city's plan to deal with the increased health and safety concerns on our block? Our block has been the destination for people preying on those living in the encampment, leading to an increase in criminal activity in the area. Here is a quick snapshot of some of the situations I've encountered over the last several weeks. Just last night, I was woken up twice due to fireworks and a dealer laying on his horn. Examples like this happen almost every night. My father-in-law texted late one night after his garage had been crashed into by a stolen vehicle, resulting in $3,000 of damage. I have comforted my kids after they've heard gunshots. We have helped a neighbor scrub graffiti off their garage. On multiple occasions, I've bandaged huge third-degree burns on a person who lives in the encampment after he burned his leg and arm on a propane heater in his tent. My children risk stepping on used needles and have witnessed things that we do not allow them to watch in screens, including violent fights, people defecating, people staggering in the street and acting strangely while they are high, people openly shooting up and dealing drugs. I struggle with even walking my kids to the bus stop. One morning, we encountered a man wielding a sword as we walked on our sidewalk. These are a few of my lived experiences, but I know that if my neighbors were up here, they would have their own stories. Four, why was the city allowing an encampment to be on a residential block on city property? We understand that many cities around the country consider residential areas high security zones in which encampments were not allowed to begin. Five, what strategies does the city have to stop the seemingly endless process of displacing encampments in one location only to have the recently evicted people create another encampment a few blocks away? We know that other U.S. cities are trying all sorts of innovative strategies to prevent this. We have been told by the city not to expect
I don't know. I wonder if she just lost connection. I think Ms. Nass gave us a good example and some good information. We're going to move on to the next testifier. Dan Fifield from The Landing. If you can please introduce yourself for the committee and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Chair Gomez, first of all, I wanted to thank you for your understanding of the issue. It is very refreshing to see that we have people in the State House that understand it, and you clearly demonstrated to me in your earlier comments that you do. So thank you for that. My name is Dan Fifield. I am the co-founder of The Landing MN. We are a nonprofit in Rochester, Minnesota that works directly with those individuals in Southeast Minnesota that are experiencing homelessness. In 2018, after being suspended from my job as an ER nurse, my wife and I founded The Landing MN. We initially started as a street outreach mission, working with those folks that were living in the skyways at the time here in Rochester. And we expanded into day center activities in correlation with the city during the pandemic, and have since opened and are running The Landing MN, which is a 7-day-a-week day center for those experiencing homelessness that functions between the hours of 8 and 7. We're currently acquiring a new building, looking at investing somewhere in the $2.25 million range for a permanent location for our day center. We offer 3 meals a day for those that are experiencing homelessness here in Rochester. Medical services, we've had 171 patients come through our clinic room so far this year. We've seen 356 unique individuals that have identified as being homelessness since the first of the year, and had 3,686 total visits to our day center. But to address the issue of unsheltered homelessness, one of the big issues that we have always experienced is I want to use the term policing of homelessness. That's the best term I can use. Rochester Police Department works very well and very closely with us. When we have these encampments that are in Rochester, we don't have anything near what Minneapolis, St. Paul has, but we do still have encampments here in town. And those individuals that are staying in those encampments are the ones that we term as being service challenged, if you will. Shelter settings are not acceptable to them because of a number of different mental health issues, social anxiety disorders, things of that nature. So their only alternative and the only setting that they have is to camp, whether it's under a bridge, whether it's in a park, whether it's on private property or public property. That is their alternative, and that is the way that they exist on a daily manner. Parks and Recreation in Rochester is the organization that has been tasked with clearing the camps. They generally give them 24 hours notice. They come in with skid loaders, with dump trucks, with garbage trucks. And as was stated earlier by Chair Gomez, they pick everything up and throw it away with little regard for what's in it, whether it's just trash or whether it's personal property. A lot of the times, our friends that are camping are woken up in the middle of the sleep pattern. They generally sleep during the day and are up at night. That's for their safety. And they aren't real coherent. They aren't really given a whole lot of time to clear their property. Sometimes they're lucky enough to get 72 hours notice, but that's not always the rule. We've tried to get city, county, parks and rec to talk with us about finding a permanent location where these individuals can camp, where they can be monitored, where they are in one spot so we can help them. It's hard to assist somebody when you don't know where they're at. It's hard to get them the services that they need when you can't find them because they've been, run out of one camp one week and another camp the next week. It does not help their mental health when you continually disrupt their environment. Granted that those environments are not safe, they're not healthy for anybody, but it is their world.
Mr. Fifield, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up. We have other testifiers. We need to get to member questions. So
all right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I do appreciate this effort. I totally support HF 4225, and thank you for that, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Fifield, for that. I see Ms. Nass is back. If you could, do you want to just do a real quick wrap-up statement?
Sure, I was almost done. Sorry about that. I was just saying, I can feel like at a minimum, if the city of Minneapolis had a transparent policy, we could at least try to hold the city accountable to that policy. but we don't even have that as a tool and have been left to try our best to navigate this on our own. My neighbors and I feel dismissed, confused, and many of my neighbors are increasingly angry due to the stress of not receiving information, support, or something, even as a response to our pleas for assistance. My heart for my house neighbors would be that they feel supported and safe so that they can show up with compassion versus fear. And my heart for the my unhoused neighbors is that they could find belonging and be in a safe space where at a minimum their basic human needs would be met. I hope that your leadership will encourage Minneapolis and other cities to create responsible, humane, and transparent policies for the benefit of all neighbors, the housed and the unhoused. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nass. Thanks for jumping back on and finishing that for us. Up next, we have Minneapolis City Council member Jason Chavez. Please introduce yourself before your testimony.
Chair Gomez, Vice Chair Keeler, and committee members, my name is Jason Chavez, and I am the Minneapolis City Council member for the 9th Ward. It's an honor to be here today. I used to be a legislative assistant here at the Minnesota House, working on the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee, and on the Workforce and Business Development Committee just last year. I'm here in support of House File 4225 that would require a city or county with more than 50,000 people to have an encampment policy. We currently do not have an encampment policy here in the city of Minneapolis, which has led to people's personal property being removed and at times destroyed. When we post encampment removals, it's usually in English, and we've also seen inhumane removals without places for people to go to. This is happening all over Minnesota, and a statewide policy and requirement would help us out tremendously. We need to ensure that our cities and counties across the state have encampment policies in place to ensure that our unhoused neighbors are being treated humanely, that we document everyone that lives in these encampments to ensure that we are actually helping them find housing before removing them, and that we help them because they're being preyed upon by dealers and oftentimes are being put in harm's way. At the same time, my neighbors do not feel safe and oftentimes fear from the needles on the ground, and they also need a policy in place to help support them. We need the statewide policy and safety support for everyone here in Minneapolis and across the state. The provisions for strong personal property, for storing personal property in the encampment, and reduction services like trash collection are important, and I appreciate you all adding this. And while you know that here in the city of Minneapolis, we're working on a policy, but we need this the statewide umbrella to make sure that we can do our job well. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Chavez. That was great. Members, we'll note that we have several pieces of written testimony that was included in the materials for today posted, and we do have one public testifier, Sue Wattler Phillips. If you could keep your testimony to 2 minutes or less, please introduce yourself for the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Sue Wattler Phillips. I'm the executive director of MICA and the president of the National Coalition for the Homeless. MICA is a interfaith group that works on being a welcoming community where we treat others the way that we want to be treated, where everyone without exception has a safe, decent, accessible home that's affordable to them. I want to thank Representative Gomez for bringing this bill forward, and thank you for your incredible passion, support, and involvement in being with and helping and listening to the needs of folks that are have been in the encampments, and thank you for your sharing earlier. We think that this bill begins to address many of the concerns that you've heard from folks in the encampments about appropriate notice, about appropriate outreach services to folks, and protecting people's belongings. One's person's trash is certainly somebody else's treasures, and we know that a lot of people's treasures have been destroyed and lost as we've had the sweeps in this process. And I think having more uniformed processes for how communities address encampments is really critical. We would like to make some recommendations and have sent some information from the National Coalition to your office in talking about that. We'd really like to look at a process of homes and not sweeping encampments. We want to have a moratorium on sweeps until we can get everybody into safe, decent, accessible, and affordable homes. Over the last 5 decades, we've seen this growing number of people experiencing homelessness in our history. You know, we had our indigenous people living in tents. We had our pioneers and homesteaders living in tents. Even in the 60s and 70s, when I was a teenager, you know, we slept out in tents on beaches and all over the place. But in the last 40, 50 years, as we have destroyed people's housing and built entertainment settings and stadiums and not replaced people housing, and people have become homeless, we treat them like they're trash. And we keep, you know, shoveling them around. And we have to stop doing that. We need to see and make sure that we have a continuum to housing for folks that were preventing people. We have immediate shelter available outreach, transitional housing, supportive housing, and affordable housing for folks. And so as we're moving forward, I think that we demand that local units of government use their American Rescue Plan dollars to meet the needs of the folks that are in the encampments. Is that there cannot be a sleep if you have dollars to put people up in
Ms. Wetlow Phillips, I'm going to ask you to wrap up, please. We just need to get to member questions still.
Thank you. And so just encourage that as we're moving forward is that we continue to work on this piece of legislation. I think there's real opportunities to have a more uniform approach to dealing with people that are living in unsheltered situations. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wetlow Phillips, for that. We'll move to member questions now. I see Lee New Brinley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I would ask quickly what the intention is for this bill. Are we going to have to vote on this in 8 minutes after almost an hour of testimony, or will we be able to carry this over to the next meeting to make sure that we can have a discussion?
We did get approved for 5 more minutes. I'll refer that over to Chair Gomez on what she wants to do moving forward after that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our intention was to vote on it in 15 minutes or 14 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. We have had almost an hour of testimony on the bill, and that leaves very little time for questions. So we'll see what we can get through. The first question I had was just the first portion of the bill relates to MnDOT contracting with cities for state-owned land so that they can do that. That's permissive language. My question is, what kind of policy does MnDOT currently have on dealing with homeless encampments?
Rep. Gomez?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So MnDOT has, I think over the last like 3 to 5 years, you know, there's been a big increase in encampments on MnDOT land. So they do have they have staff that is detailed to deal with it. They face a challenge in terms of storing people's property because they're funded by trunk highway funds. I know Rep. Cagle will be more familiar with this, but that it's not a use that they can, they can't use their funding to do some of the things that they would need to do to manage encampments that's on their public land. Oh, and obviously Chair Hornstein. Sorry, Vice Chair, we have big transpo expertise and she had her hand up, so I thought of her. But so they are dealing with it. I think they're doing actually a really incredible job. They, had feedback on the bill, but want greater collaboration with local entities to kind of clear up some of the questions, because in a lot of cases, it's sort of like whoever's land the encampment happens to pop up on is sort of the responsible entity. I think we're moving away from that more and more, but that's a concern for MnDOT.
Lee New Brinley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if Representative Horstein or Representative Cagle want to talk about that. But so is there currently an actual written policy? You say that they're dealing with it. But do they currently have an adopted policy on this?
Chair Gomez?
I don't know if they have a written policy.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess a similar question would likely be for Councilmember Chavez, actually. I'm wondering, and obviously this can happen anywhere. These encampments can pop up anywhere, but certainly this has been a very significant issue in the city, primarily of Minneapolis, but also in St. Paul. And so I had actually had written down the question of what policies have they adopted, but it sounds like they haven't adopted a policy. So I'm wondering if Councilmember Chavez can elaborate on that, why the city that is experiencing this has not adopted a policy on how to deal with it. What is getting in the way? What are the barriers? What are the struggles? Because that would probably help us in shaping whatever comes forward.
Council Member Chavez?
Just hasn't been an internal policy or a policy in place to the public. And that's just something we're working on right now. And as a council member, that's something I'm working on with my constituents to figure out how we can develop one. So there isn't an answer to your question necessarily, just that we don't have one. And I'm going to be working with my colleagues to get one passed.
Lee New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Councilmember Chavez. This is really concerning to me that we are sort of pushing off some problems. And I appreciate Chair Gomez, your willingness to acknowledge that there are some issues that need to be dealt with, and that, you know, the bill is not necessarily ready as it is, and that we can work on this going forward. I think a particular concern is what you mentioned actually about MnDOT, and one of their primary concerns is they can't use their funding for storage. And that makes sense. I appreciate that explanation. But one of the things that I am concerned about is the requirements for local cities to adopt these policies. Many folks on the committee even have visited one of my police departments in Lindstrom as part of the bonding tour. And I would suggest, certainly two of the police departments absolutely in my district do not have the capacity or the space for storage. And I suspect that's true just in my district. I suspect that would be a significant concern across the state, particularly for our small to police departments. I mean, one of mine literally offices, the police department is in a pole building. They are incredibly tight for space already. So that is certainly a concern to me. Sorry, I'm trying to look through my notes quickly because I know that we don't have much time. I also have concerns. And in fact, I would ask a question on lines 3.18, 3.21. There's an acknowledgement, and I appreciate the acknowledgement of the potential of funeral services and encampments popping up in a cemetery. However, there is still a requirement here for 24 hours notice to be removed. My concern is that, well, what if this pops up 20 hours before a funeral service is to happen in a cemetery? It seems like we need a different solution there, that there needs to be an acknowledgement that this is sort of a sacred space that is off limits. And if those encampments pop up, they need to be dealt with probably immediately. I think there are a lot of concerns with the specific language and how to deal with that. But again, I appreciate Representative Gomez that you've acknowledged that and are willing to work on that. It seems to me that this committee is the place to work on that and to work through those issues. We are the people who are hearing very specifically about these issues every week, and this is the place to do that. So I would hope and I would suggest that we keep this bill here in our committee to work through these issues and get these things resolved before moving this up the chain. Like I said, I know we don't have time, so I will forego the rest of my questions. But I do think there is more work to be done, and I'm particularly concerned about the language of a mandate. This language is shall. Yep. It is must. And this is going to create a pretty significant burden, particularly on small cities and municipalities throughout the state, who, number one, don't have the same problem that we are dealing with in the same way in our urban core, but also don't have the same resources and infrastructure available to deal with it in this way. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Gomez.
Thank you. Thanks, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative New Brindley. I think you're right. And I've been texting with our CA, so I think we should change the plan, and we should lay this over so that we have a chunk of time next week to dig into some of the issues that you've identified and other things that come up. I think that a few of the points that you raised are totally the things that kind of jump out to me as like, okay, need to be worked on, but I'm open to that approach, and so I thank you for the recommendation. I think that's smart. So to be continued next week. Yeah.
Lee New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that.
Okay, so with that, I think we'll probably just. With that, I'm going to turn it back over to the chair, because I think we're going to lay this bill over to have further conversation, unless do you want to go to Representative Cagle's
question quickly because we do have 1 minute left.
Madam Chair, it looks like she wants to go briefly.
Okay. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will be real quick. You know, I think a lot of this comes back to harm reduction and making sure that we have safe spaces for people to practice harm reduction. And, you know, that's something that we've been talking about at the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council. And I think we really need to start thinking seriously about that.
Madam Chair, I think that's a good note to end on, to be continued next week. Thank you.
We will meet again next Wednesday, March 23rd. Oh, go ahead, Chair.
Oh, we have to lay it over.
I think we just need to make a motion to lay the bill over.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so.
Wait, can it be a voice vote?
We don't need to vote on that one, Madam Chair.
Oh, then I make a motion that we lay this bill over and we'll talk about it next committee.
Yep. Well. Okay.
Okay, go, Chair.
Okay, I'd like to move, Madam Chair, that House File 4225 be laid over.
And I believe the bill is laid over.
Great. Thank you. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 23rd. With that, the meeting is adjourned.